Dry though he may be, Jay Powell does let you know what he's thinking.
If the totality of the data were to indicate that faster tightening is warranted, we'd be prepared to increase the pace of rate hikes.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 7th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, twice a year, the chair of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors is required by law to make the trek up Capitol Hill and spend 2 days, one each in the Senate and the House, answering lawmakers' questions about the economy, how the Fed's managing it, and anything else that's on lawmakers' minds. Mostly, the past year or so, the questions have been about inflation, how high it is, and what exactly the central bank's going to do about it.
So just quickly, at the end of last year, we saw a couple of very promising, modest inflationary readings in November and December.
Inflation was, in fact, getting better back then.
But earlier this year, some of that improvement was revised away.
Oh, right.
In addition, we got a very strong reading on inflation in January, also a very strong jobs reading, also very strong retail sales.
To be clear, a strong jobs report and strong retail sales, while great if you're a regular person in this economy, are not great if it's your job to control inflation.
And so, as I pointed out in my testimony, we're looking at a reversal, really, of what we thought we were seeing to some extent, a partial reversal. It's still true. It's still the case that we're seeing progress on inflation.
Progress, yes, but not as much progress or as fast as the Fed would like. Still, though,
we're seeing goods inflation has come down significantly. There's improvement in housing inflation in the pipeline.
That is true.
There's not a lot of improvement yet to be seen in the largest sector, which is non-housing services. So core inflation is running at 4.7% on a 12-month basis.
4.7% over the past year. Remember, the Fed wants inflation to be at 2%. All that Powell tape I played just now, by the way, was one long answer. We just chopped it up a bit to get to the real bottom line of the Fed chair's testimony today, which was this, the very long end of that very long answer.
I think nothing about the data suggests to me that we've tightened too much. Mm-hmm. Indeed, it suggests that we still have work to do.
Still have work to do. One of the big questions about how inflation is going to get tamed is how much the labor market needs to suffer. And in fact, that came up today. Whether unemployment needs to go up a lot for inflation to come down. We don't actually know yet, but there is a related question here. How much of the income pie in this economy goes to workers? Because if companies are okay making a little bit less money, they can theoretically keep more workers. Now, will that happen? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes it from there.
There are ways, theoretically, for inflation to fall without tons of people getting laid off. Productivity growth, increasing labor supply, and there's another way, says Sarah House, senior economist at Wells Fargo.
That's if businesses accept lower profit margins. So if basically businesses are absorbing some of that additional cost of workers.
By one argument, there's space for that to happen. Martin Ledau, a professor of economics at UC Berkeley, looked at how much profit has gone to workers and how much has gone to the stock market through dividends, for example.
In our work, we found that the ratio of that notion of profits has increased as a total share relative to labor.
If you look at a chart showing the share of gross domestic income, all the income in the whole economy, from 1980 to now, you can see that workers' share has gone down from about 58% to 53%, and corporate profits' share has gone up from around 8% to 12%. But it all depends on how you slice things. Erica York is a senior economist at the Tax Foundation.
You don't see this pattern of a dramatic decline in labor share when you're looking at net measures of gross domestic income.
Basically, she says, if you look at how much income goes to labor versus capital and net out things like taxes and depreciation, labor's share is stable. Still, Dario Perkins, managing director at TS Lombard, believes power in the economy is shifting to labor.
Because labor markets are so tight, we're beginning to see workers starting to sort of claw back some of those losses.
Whether that is true or not is going to shape what this economy looks like in a few years and what a recession, if there is one, would do to the labor market. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, you can probably guess how traders reacted to Powell's bottom line message. We will have the details when we do the numbers. You might have missed it, but the Fed gave us a sneak peek of what Chair Powell was going to say today when it released its semi-annual monetary report to Congress on Friday. They go hand in hand, the testimony and the report, and there are lots of good tidbits in there, including the Fed's thoughts on why the labor market is still so tight and why it might not actually get back to where it was in the before times. One key factor? Excess retirements. At the moment, 2.2 million more people than economists and demographers had been expecting are retired. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at why, as far as we can tell, and what that might mean for the economy yet to come.
There are literally millions of personal stories about why older workers retired earlier than they planned during the pandemic. They were scared of COVID. They cashed in on the hot housing market and record-breaking 401ks. They took a buyout package at work, or they were laid off. Teresa Ghilarducci, a labor economist at the New School, says coaxing them back to work would help companies facing labor shortages.
They could be more clever in dipping into that reserve army.
Especially in industries like healthcare and childcare. But
a lot of employers would rather not.
She says age discrimination helped boost layoffs for older workers and keep them on the sidelines. Plus, they often come with higher salaries. Also, some retired workers just don't want to come back. Alicia Minnell directs the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College.
If you're in your 60s and you're treading water for 3 years, can I just count you as retired? We're getting to that point.
3 years is a lot of working life. So if someone retired early, they may have just hit their planned retirement age. And in reality, these 2 million plus excess retirements shouldn't be that shocking, says Catherine Ann Edwards, a labor economist at the Rand Corporation. Retirement rates have been increasing as boomers age.
Rather than incremental, it was a large exodus from the labor force of people who were going to leave pretty soon anyway. The story is genuinely about 30 years of labor force trends that we have been very slow to see, and I think a little reluctant to see.
It's another way the pandemic has had an outsized effect on certain populations and put a spotlight on the holes in our economy. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
I mentioned up at the top of the program that Fed Chair Powell said today, he said again today, actually, because he says it all the time, that the central bank is going to follow the data as it tries to figure out how high to raise interest rates. The catch is that a lot of the data that the Fed relies on and a bunch of other economic policymakers rely on, too, comes from surveys of the American people. And since the beginning of the pandemic, response rates to those surveys have plummeted. Reed Pickert is an economic reporter for Bloomberg who wrote recently about those response rates, why they matter, and what government agencies are doing about it. Reed, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So let's dig in. Before we get to the why it matters part, which is the really important part, I want you to talk to me about the JOLTS survey, right? Job opening, labor turnover survey that we talk about here on this program all the time. It's been in the news a lot because of all the job openings that are out there. Response rates for that survey have dropped off the table.
They have. You know, if you think back to sometime around, let's say, September of 2017, the response rate for this survey was around 64%. And if you fast forward 5 years later, the response rate has dropped to less than half of that, so to just under 31%, which obviously is an enormous decline. And when we think about what this data has done in recent months, it's been particularly volatile. So some economists have started to wonder if some of that volatility, at least in some part of it, is likely influenced by that sharp drop in response rates.
So just to put some numbers to this, the government sends out something like 20,000 surveys, and we used to get 60% of them back, and now we get 30% of them back. Tell me why that matters.
Right. So the actual calculation is a little more complex, but overall, the picture of why this matters kind of revolves around this idea of non-response bias. And that's essentially a fancy way of saying that, you know, if the people not responding to the survey are systematically different than those that do, then you have a problem. So if a local flower shop, for instance, doesn't send in their retail sales in any given month, it may be okay. But that would be really different if an enormous company like Amazon didn't send in their data.
To be clear, at least for now, based on your reporting and the experts you've talked to, the data is still valid.
That's correct.
Okay. This is a question I probably should have led with, but why is this happening?
So the one answer that I got to this question from everyone I asked is that there is no one reason for this decline. It ranges everything from this idea of, you know, eroding trust in government and institutions to everything to, you know, caller ID, less landlines. But you also just have this general survey fatigue in that when you look around, you know, there's a survey at the end of every customer service call and at the bottom of your receipt when you go to
and I always say no, so maybe I'm the problem.
So exactly. And if you say no in that case, it really doesn't matter. But if you say no to these surveys that inform some of the most important statistics that we have to look at, it really does become a problem.
Okay, so let's take the JOLTS survey that we started with. Response rates are plummeting. At some point, if current trends continue, there will be no companies responding to the JOLTS survey. Then what? What's the government doing to make sure we don't get there?
So hopefully we never get there. But the government is very clear-eyed about this being a big problem. And the main kind of tactic that they're taking is this idea of blended statistics. So when you think about that, it's essentially asking people and businesses the questions that you can only get from those people and businesses through surveys, and then using this range of other data that we get and collect through a variety of different third-party sources, this non-survey data, to kind of blend these statistics to get something that's accurate and, you know, in some cases, more detailed than the survey version. And there's already some degree of this taking place. I can circle this back around to the closely watched CPI, Consumer Price Index.
It's everything.
So for instance, their used car prices, they use, JD Power Information Network. So there's a lot of different options here, but it's almost overwhelming to think about how big of a lift this is to do this across so many different indicators when they come out pretty much every day.
All the time. Reed Pickert covers the economy at Bloomberg, writing most recently about survey responses and what it means that they are declining. Reed, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time and your reporting.
Thank you so much.
Coming up.
Nobody asks why someone's opening a sports bar, right?
Nobody does. In fact, so why are people asking about opening a lesbian bar? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's today. Dow Industrial's down 574, 1.7%, closed at 32,856. The NASDAQ down 145 points, about 1.25%, 11,530. The S&P 500 declined 62 points, 1.5%, 39.86. This is the kind of thing Jay Powell is probably thinking about here. Wholesale prices for used cars surged 4.3% in February. That's per the Manheim Used Vehicle Index, and it is the third consecutive monthly increase. Wholesale prices still down about 7% from a year ago. Store sales at Dick's Sporting Goods increased 5.3% in the quarter that included the holidays, twice as much as analysts had predicted. The company said it made progress in supply chain stuff and that its inventory is, quote, in great shape. Remember how much we've been talking about inventory. Shares up nearly 11% today. Bonds basically stable. 10-year T-note 3.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the things the Biden administration has said about doing is trying to increase competition in this economy. Federal agencies have taken aim at bank overdraft fees and non-compete agreements. They've let hearing aids be sold over the counter. This week, the White House put the agricultural seed sector on notice. There's a new working group looking at market concentration in that industry, and Marketplace's Savannah Marr has that story.
You know that meme of a really intense-looking guy in front of a bulletin board with crisscrossed red string outlining his conspiracy theory? That's Phil Howard, charting decreased competition in the seed sector.
Yeah, it's a lot to keep track of.
Howard is a professor at Michigan State, and he's been at this since the 90s. His latest graphic shows how over 60% of global seed sales are controlled by just four firms.
They've made hundreds of acquisitions of formerly independent seed companies. The power of the seed industry is held in fewer and fewer hands.
Howard says the farmers buying those seeds have fewer choices and pay higher prices. The history of consolidation in this particular market tracks with a loosening of antitrust regulation throughout the economy. There were thousands of independent mom-and-pop seed suppliers until about the mid-80s. Eleanor Fox is a professor emerita at the NYU School of Law.
Since that time, the antitrust law has been not too intrusive.
Starting under Reagan, she says regulators and courts increasingly approve big mergers and acquisitions that consolidate markets.
The Biden administration is trying to buck that, and it's not easy.
Because, Fox says, it can't exactly bust up mergers that have already happened. But Phil Howard at Michigan State says it can take a harder look at the intellectual property issues at play.
There have been a lot of problems with the current system for patents, really broad patent claims being made by these big firms.
Howard says that prevents smaller seed breeders from entering the market, innovating, and competing with the big four. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
There's a new bar and restaurant that's just opened up in an otherwise nondescript strip mall on Sunset Boulevard, a couple of miles from Marketplace World Headquarters. And it would be an otherwise nondescript bar and restaurant in that nondescript strip mall, except for this relevant fact. According to the Lesbian Bar Project, which is a group that started in the early days of the pandemic to fundraise for lesbian bars, in the 1980s, there were, give or take, 200 lesbian bars in the United States. Now there are just 27. Los Angeles had a grand total of none for years after the last one closed in 2017. But that changed a couple of weeks ago when that new place in the strip mall called the Ruby Fruit opened up.
Hi.
How are you? I'm Kai.
Hi, I'm Mara.
Nice to see you, Mara. How are you?
Hi, Emily.
Good to see you.
Nice
How are
to
you?
Meet you?
Mara Herbkersman and Emily Billigas met working at the restaurant that used to be in this spot. It closed earlier this year. Mara and Emily painted a couple of walls pink, lined them with books and wine bottles, and Mara takes it from there.
I have been, you know, over the last several years trying to figure out where my space in this industry is. I've been running restaurants for a long time, mm-hmm. and front of house and back of the house. And last summer, I was sort of, you know, thinking about what LA was missing and brought this up to Emily, literally on a shift at Azette. We were just kind of daydreaming.
Azette is the restaurant
the
that used
restaurant,
to be in this
correct.
Space. Right.
The artist yeah. formerly known as Azette. You know, we started to kind of run with this idea of opening a sapphic space in LA because there wasn't anything permanent.
Which is amazing, and we'll get there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's pretty wild. So this literally started as just daydreaming at work. And we were doing some pop-ups at the end of the year out of my Volkswagen Westfalia van.
Yeah, I read about that. What was that like?
It was a blast.
So fun.
It was really fun. We were selling hot.
It was proof of concept, right? I mean, that's kind of what you were doing.
That's what it was designed to do.
Right.
That was time for us to figure out if we liked working together too, because we had worked together at the restaurant, which is one thing. But in terms of managing together, that's an entirely different ballgame.
Yep.
This might have gone by people pretty quickly. This is a sapphic space of which there aren't any like permanent established or haven't been for a very long time in Los Angeles. Why was it important to you two to be the pathbreakers in establishing a lesbian bar in Los Angeles?
I mean, I don't necessarily think I knew a few months ago that it was going to be my destiny.
Sitting in it. It's kind of wild.
It's very wild. And a lot of what happened feels very right place, right time.
Tell me what happened.
Well, what happened was the owners of the restaurant wanted to sell. And so they offered it to Mara. And I don't know, a few weeks later, you had been thinking very seriously about it, Mara, and you approached me and asked me if I wanted to do it with you.
How long did it take you to say yes?
I said yes pretty immediately, but then I said, wait, give me a week.
I think I said, wait. I hear you saying yes. I'm like, but you need to really think about it.
Mara was like, I need you to really consider this is going to change everything in your life. And I was like, okay, fair enough.
Was she right?
Oh, 100%. Yes. Yeah.
How is it possible that this is the first lesbian bar to open in Los Angeles in a very long time?
I think it unfortunately makes so much sense because I think there's not as much visibility for sapphic women and people than there are for gay men at times. Mm-hmm. Like,
oh, for
you know,
sure.
West Hollywood is this amazing, like, vibrant community, but there's not as much representation, I think, for the sapphic community. It is pretty well known that women have a harder time getting capital in business.
True for you?
Yes and no. I mean, we're not fully funded yet. Mm-hmm. So I can definitely speak to being a new business owner that it's difficult to get funding, at least from banks and things, because you need to have assets and other capital, which doesn't make any sense because we're just getting started. So we're still trying to kind of put some pieces together as far as that goes.
Tell me who your customers are. I guess a better way to put that question is tell me who the community you want in this place is.
We want people to feel comfortable here. And people of all kinds, for sure. That being said, we are explicitly for members of the lesbian community. And we've gotten a fair amount of questions regarding, like, why? Why a lesbian bar? Why?
Really? Because somebody opens a gay bar and they don't get that question.
That's really a good point. Yeah.
Yes.
It's really wild how many people are asking why.
And
So what do you say?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this because, to me, as a lesbian, the answer is very obvious. An analogy I've been using recently is, like, nobody asks why someone's opening a sports bar.
Right.
Right? Let me share an anecdote, actually.
Sure.
I feel like this will be easier. On Friday night, we were playing Come to My Window Radio. So, Come to My Window by Melissa Etheridge. A lesbian anthem, if you will.
I will.
So, a whole radio station on Spotify based on that song. And 32 Flavors by Ani DiFranco came on. And all of a sudden, one of our bartenders, Shannon, was like, Emily, Sarah wants you in the back. So, I go to the back. One of our line cooks, Sarah, who's queer. And she was like, I just wanted to tell you that my first girlfriend in high school put this song on a mix for me. But my mom threw the mix CD away because it was a gay relationship. And she was like coming to tears and getting a little teary-eyed when she was saying this. And she's like, it is so cool to hear this song and be at work serving food to other lesbians. And we've all sort of had some varying degree of that. And it's a healing thing to come together and just be able to be like, and now let's have a glass of wine.
And, you know, all together.
All together.
In one place. Right. Yeah.
How does the fact that you're trying to establish and serve a community here Does that affect your business calculation? Probably not, right? I mean, you're just doing, running a business.
Yeah, we're just running a business.
Yeah. And I do think the one thing that whenever I get really twisted around in my head with the numbers and the margins and the profit and the what and how are we going to pay our staff.
It's a horrible thing.
And I go like,
right.
And then I think, okay, but our community is so huge that is what we always have on our side, because I do feel like we're offering something that people have not had in a really long time.
And something unique, because there are parties. You know, a lot of people throwing.
Not establishments.
Exactly. There's not a permanent establishment. And also, we really want to be offering more of like a neighborhood kind of experience, a little bit more intimate experience. So there's a new bar also called Honey's, which seems so amazing. We've met the owners, and they are incredibly talented people. I think also there's space for both of us, too, because they are really a nightlife spot.
And we close at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They close at 2 a.m. Yeah. I mean, this is stop number one.
Yes.
You come here, you get your grilled prawns.
Have a glass of wine.
And have a nice, you know, Sauvignon Blanc.
And then you go wash your hands.
And then you go, exactly.
And we will be at home in bed.
Uh-huh. Yes. I hear you. Well, look, good luck.
Thanks
for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out, you have heard enough tape from Jay Powell today, so I will just summarize one last thing he said. In response to a question about what would happen if the debt limit isn't raised, as Republicans in the House are threatening, Chair Powell said that the consequences would be, and this is the quote, extraordinarily adverse. All right, we got to go. I talked a little bit too much today, so no time for a moment of economic context. Maybe we'll do two tomorrow, just to make it up to you. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the executive director of she's on digital too. Digital and on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdal. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.